May 13th, 2010, San Diego. And we're going to look at goals and how do we know where we're going and how to get there. Everybody like to go someplace? Achieve something? No, you don't care? I mean, even the dogs want to achieve something. They want to find a nice... Oh, hi! Hi, Krishna. So nice to see you. And the whole crew. And congratulations on your graduation. I didn't get to see them last time I was here. So research shows that only 3% of people set goals in their life. And those 3% of people achieve 80% more than the 97% that don't set any goals. So there's, because of these statistics, there is a lot of impetus. All right, let's set goals in our life. What would we like to accomplish? I mean, if you don't have a goal, it's something like, okay, I'm going to drive from San Diego to New York, and I get 72 hours, but I don't have a map. So I can use the sun, I can use a compass, I can stop on the way and ask for directions, but who knows when I'm going to get there, and when I get there, I'm probably going to be so stressed that I'm saying I'm never doing this drive again. So a lot of people sort of go through life like that. Okay, I have some idea of where I want to go and where I want to get there. I don't know how I'm going to get there. Also, a lot of times the goals that people have are not what we're going to talk about tonight as ultimate goals. The goals people often set for themselves are, okay, I want to make $1 million by the time I'm 35. I want to own my own house by the time I'm 32. Isn't that the kind of goals people, you know, I want to own my own sailboat when I'm 40. I want to just keep my job. I want to learn 5 foreign languages, something like that. But we're going to distinguish a little bit here between goals and route. It's like I was saying, drive to New York and then you have your route. So really those things that most people call goals, I want to keep my job, I want to stay married, I want to learn 5 languages, I want to make a lot of money. Those really are not goals. Those are means. Those are a route. Those are how we want to get someplace. If we really think about what our goals are, we'll find that there's universal goals. If you ask somebody, what do you get by getting money that's even more important than the money, you'll get things like, well, I get freedom, I get happiness, I get security, I get power, I get status, right? So I made a little list here of goals, which are the reasons driving why we want to make $1 million or have a big house or find the perfect soulmate or whatever. One is that we have a goal that we want to celebrate. One of the things that's driving us is we want to have celebrations in our life. We especially want to celebrate things that are milestones, right? Achievements, birthdays, some sort of marking in life. We also want to have fun. One of our goals is to have fun. A lot of the reason people want to learn the 5 languages or make a lot of money or get a big house is they want to have fun. They want to enjoy. They want to have pleasure. Another goal that we have is just to be alive. But not just alive, you know, in a wheelchair hooked up to a bunch of tubes. We want to be full of life, full of vitality, full of health. So a lot of what we work for is for that, for vital life. And we also want to have truth in our life. We're working for something that's real, something that's authentic, something that's true. We want our relationships to be authentic. We want the people that we deal with and the situations we deal with to be truthful, to be honest. We're also working for meaning. The kind of job we want to have, where we want to live, the people that we associate with are to give meaning in our life. We want to do something that we think has some importance, has some value. If people are working at a job that they feel is meaningless, then they want to do something voluntarily on the weekends or in the evening to do something that makes a difference to somebody. We want to be creative. We want to create something, maybe even if it's just muffins in the kitchen, or whatever. We want to produce something. And we want a sense of who we are, finding ourselves, doing something that really gives me a sense of autonomy and freedom, that I can express who I am as an individual. And that's, of course, tied into being authentic. I want some place where I can really be my real self. And then I want to connect with other life, whether it's walking in the park and being with the trees, or being with my significant other, or in some way I want to connect with some other living being, or some other living beings. And I want that connection to be full of respect and consideration and appreciation and love, ultimately. So these are really our goals. And if we think about, if you could make a list of the things that you're working for in life, you'd see, you say, why am I working for that? I'm working for that to get food. Why do I want food? Because I want to be alive. And I want to be healthy. I want to be full of life. Because I want to have fun. Because I want to have nice relationships. And if you look at all the things that we're working for in our life, you'll see that the reasons for working for them are what I've just listed. Maybe I've missed something, but I think they're pretty much covered the whole gamut. Celebration, fun, life, authenticity, truth, knowledge, meaning, creativity, a sense of self, and that sense of self is very much tied into freedom, the ability to express myself, and that connection with life. So if we think of these as our goals, and then what we're doing in life to get there, the next question is, well, is what I'm doing in life actually getting me there? In other words, do I have the right map? Now, I would guess that a lot of people don't really even think about what their ultimate goals are. They just think, I want to be a millionaire by 35, or I want to have a job that's satisfying me, and they never say, well, why do I want those things? What do I hope those things will give me? Where do I hope those things are taking me? And therefore, it's very difficult to evaluate how successful their strategies are, because they don't know where they're going. As we say, if you don't know where you're going, you probably won't get there. Now, people ask me all the time, is such and such a good school? Guess what my first question is? What do you consider good? How are you defining good? What's your list of criteria against which I should measure the school? So if you say, well, is that relationship working out? Is that job worth it? Do you like living in San Diego? Really, when we're asking those questions, we're saying, are they meeting those goals? Are they bringing us those things that everybody is striving for? Now, each of us has a list of ways in which we're trying to achieve those goals. So for some people, it's getting a good education, having a well-paying job that uses my talents, living in a place like San Diego that's supposed to be one of the nicest places in the world to live, like finding the perfect spouse, having the right set of clothes, having the right bunch of electronic equipment. For other people, it's doing things like going into people's houses at night and robbing them, right? Or just sitting on the sofa watching reruns of movies all day. But different people have different lists of things they're doing that they're feeling are going to give them those results that we're all looking for. And we might ask us a couple questions. Well, is what I'm doing getting me what I want? Honestly. And why did I decide to do these particular things? Why did I decide that these things I'm doing are what's going to get me where I want to go? If we think of the choices we make in life, what do I eat? How do I make a living? Where do I live? With whom do I associate? How do I behave? As the choices is whether I turn right or left, or whether I go straight, or whether I go on the highway, or whether I go on a regular road to go to these destinations. So how am I deciding that? How am I deciding to turn right here, turn left here, go straight here, go on this road? And how do I know they're going to bring me to where I want to go? So that's the main question I want to look at tonight. Because we're all making these decisions on a minute-to-minute basis, and certainly a daily or weekly or monthly or yearly basis. How do I hope to find life and authenticity? How do I hope to find myself? How do I hope to connect with other people? So in chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks a lot about knowledge and the goal of knowledge, jnana and jnaya. So we've already talked about the goal of knowledge. But knowledge itself, in this sense, is what do I do to achieve that goal? Well, why did we decide to do certain things? Why did we decide that getting a good education is more likely to get me life and happiness and good relationships? Where did that idea come from? Parent, you heard it from somebody. Somebody told you. Probably a lot of somebody's told you. If you do this, it will take you there. You know, you go. Here you are driving to New York, and you stop and ask for directions, and everyone says, okay, turn right over there, go on that highway. And hopefully you believe the person. So, you know, your parents and your teachers and the government, everyone's telling you this is the way you get to those goals. So one way is by hearing from somebody that we trust. Right? Or maybe you heard from people who said, oh, the way to achieve your goals is to smoke marijuana and hang out on the couch and watch reruns of movies. And you believe that. Doesn't it? Some people believe that. So who you've heard from. And then how else do we decide? Success stories. All right, well, that's another way of sort of hearing from others. I look at people who've gotten the good education or who sat around on the couch all day watching reruns or whatever it is that I'm doing with my life. And I say, have they achieved those things? And another way. We experiment. Now, it's kind of hard to do too many experiments. Of course, the Bhagavad Gita teaches us that we've probably done a lot of experiments. The Bhagavad Gita teaches us that this is not our first life. So we've probably tried many different routes in various lifetimes. Probably one lifetime we tried robbing banks, and another lifetime we tried just hanging out on the sofa, and another lifetime we tried getting, you know, an MD and a PhD. And another lifetime we tried this way, and another lifetime we try out different things. And sometimes even in this life we try out different things. And we see if they work. Of course, it's hard to try out a whole lot of things to the conclusion in one life, right? You can only go so far down the road before you say, I wonder if this is getting me to the goals or not. So you have to sort of be able to tell by the signposts in the early stages, am I getting closer or not? So we hear from authorities that we trust. We look at the examples of other people who are either a lot further down the road than we are or already there. And we also try our own experiment. All right. So, looking at the way that in this society, where most of us are told that we'll achieve these goals, I'm going to ask, does it work? Can we say that, you know, well over the 90% of people who follow the standard map given by modern society, do they achieve those goals? Would you say that well over 90% of people who get a good education have a life full of celebration and fun and authenticity and good relationships? And what about money? Do well over 90% of people who have a lot of money have a life full of really good relationships and celebration, authenticity and freedom and meaning? And obviously some do. Right? What are some other big things in society? Education, money. Oh, a satisfying job. Do over 90% of people who have a satisfying job, do they feel have a life full of celebration and fun and authenticity and good connection with other people? In fact, what we find is that the media is full of stories of people who have all of those things. People who have wealth, people who have education, beauty, fame, money, power. And they haven't achieved those goals. And obviously some do to some extent. But it certainly isn't the vast majority. Is it even 60, 70%? All right, well, if you have a map where not even 60% of the people who follow the map achieve the goal, then either those people who don't know how to follow the map or they're following the wrong map. So usually we conclude, well, they just don't know how to follow the map. I'll do it right. But if we just examine in history even, say, here's all these people. They followed the map. They did what they were told to do. They got the degree. They got on the line. Whatever map you're following, do the vast majority achieve those goals? And do they achieve those goals in a permanent state? Do they achieve them maybe for 5 minutes or a week, or is it permanent? So that should tell us if the map probably, there's something wrong with the map. Now, what's really interesting is that the people who develop these maps know there's something wrong with them. In fact, they know there's a lot wrong with them. But still, they try to sell us the map. And could you imagine going to a gas station and saying, you know, okay, I want to go to LA, do you have a map? And they say, well, we have a map here, but it's not an accurate map. And we're not sure what parts of it are accurate and what parts of it are not. We're not even sure what percentage of it is accurate. We know for sure that it's not 100% accurate. But we'd like to sell it to you for $10. Would you buy it? But that's what we're doing in modern society. The leaders of our society are saying, here's the map to achieve your goals. Now, for people in general, they say, here's the map and it works. You see all the commercials, right? You buy the new car and everybody's smiling. We have achieved celebration, fun, connection with life, freedom, expression, creativity by buying this car. Eh? Or by using this laundry soap. Or mouthwash. Or by buying this insurance policy. So for people in general, they're saying, our maps work. But you know, when you go in the back rooms, they say, we know our maps don't work. So it's really interesting at the doctoral level when we talked about the philosophy behind scientific research. They were very open. They said, we don't really know what's going on in the world. We don't know how the world works at all. We don't even know if we know, or how we know, or what we don't know. We don't know anything. So I thought I'd read you the list of what the people who are producing the map have to say privately. Not in the commercials. And we're going to look at two main maps that are being sold, main categories of maps that are being sold now as how you're going to achieve your goals. And this is a little academic. One is called positivism, and one is called post-positivism, or modernism and postmodernism. Now, that doesn't mean modernism like now, and postmodernism means the future. I don't know why they've come up with those terms. Well, actually, I do, because somebody wrote a book called Positive This, and then they called it Post-Positive. So positivism is the idea that, it's also called empiricism, that we can know with our senses and our mind what's real and what's not real, what's true and what's not true. We can devise a working map of reality that will take you to your goals just with our senses and mind. There is objective reality out there, and we can perceive it materially. And therefore, we can tell you this is how to attain pleasure and celebration and community and autonomy and freedom, because we can understand everything. At least it's possible to understand everything. And the post-positivist says, we don't think that's true. We either think that there's no objective reality, or if there is an objective reality, you can't achieve knowledge of it with your mind and senses. Therefore, everybody should just create their own reality. And whatever reality you create, if it works for you, it works for you. So that's the post-positivist. So first we're going to look at the problems with positivism. And there are six. Again, this is a little different. The first one is called the Duhem Quine Thesis and Auxiliary Assumptions. That's pretty simple. Sure. It's a complicated name. Is that better? But it's a pretty simple idea. And that is that it's impossible to say what causes what because there might be another factor. And this is especially true when it comes to human behavior, but it's even true when it comes to medicine. You know, so I've worked in education, and what is it that gets one kid to learn and another kid not to learn? Well, you can never have the conditions exactly equal and just change one little thing, right? Even with your twins, they're different people. Right? There's the people factor.
You can never know exactly. Maybe there's another cause. Or you may be ascribing the wrong cause. Or you're also making assumptions. Just like in mathematics, we make an assumption that two parallel lines will never meet. Well, how do we know what happens at the edges of the universe? Maybe they do. Do we know? Has anybody ever followed two parallel lines out to infinity? I know we just put those little arrows on the end of it. Right? I was teaching my grandson this about a week ago, the difference between a line and a line segment. So a line has a little arrows because it goes on forever. But did anybody ever follow the little arrows on forever to see? I mean, do we know? We don't know. So that's the first problem, is you have to make assumptions. You have to. How are you going to do math without assuming that two parallel lines will never meet? But maybe they do. Or maybe they do on Mars. Maybe they don't here, but maybe they do someplace else. So that's the first problem. Second problem is the problem of induction. It gives you only probable results, not absolute results, and you don't know what the probability is. So, the typical, all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. But how do you know all men are mortal? Maybe there's some guy living in the Amazon rainforest up in a tree, that's 10,000 years old and you just haven't found him yet. You don't know. And you don't know what your probability is. Like, I was going to do research originally on all the children who were brought up in the Hare Krishna movement. And I quickly realized that nobody knew what that number was. And you'd never be able to figure it out. How many are there? How many were there? So whenever you're using your senses and your logic, all you can say is, for all of the things that I've seen, this is true so far. But you don't know what percentage of all the things there are you've seen. Okay? And the next one may prove you wrong, and it happens in science all the time. Weren't we taught this in school, right? You do some experiments, and then you try it. And after you replicate it so many times, you say, okay, it's true. Actually, they don't say it's true. What they say is, as far as we know, it's not been proven false. You know they never say it's true? Because you can't. All you can say is, as far as we know. But again, if you don't know how many of the total you've looked at, you don't know what even your probability is. Are you 90% sure? Are you 50% sure? Are you 10% sure? You don't even know what that percentage is. Okay. Next one is the social nature. All of us have social biases according to the particular historical time that we live in. For example, between World War I and World War II, people in Europe commonly married before they were 16. That was normal. Now, we have a social bias. If we see a 12-year-old getting married, we're horrified, but that used to be normal. So how you evaluate things depends on the particular historical context that you live in. What's normal at one point is abnormal at another point. And that's true for everything that we look at. We're viewing it through a particular social lens. Then there's something that we all experience in our relationships, that what's obvious to me may not be obvious to you. I'm with somebody, I know them, I live with them, and I say, can't you see it? It's obvious. And I don't see that. It's not obvious at all. We call this relativity of the light of reason. Right? The light goes on in my head. Ah, that's it! You go, no, it's not. That's it. I say, no, that's it. Right? What I may think is absolutely true may be relatively true. It may be my perspective. Then what's called theory-laden observation. So what I observe is based on what I expect to see. And it was a very, very famous card experiment done. Let's see, who was it done by? Brunner and Postman in 1949. If you want to go look this up. So they took a deck of cards. Everybody knows a deck of cards, right? It has four suits. My 3-year-old grandson liked to separate the cards into just blacks and reds, and I was trying to show him, but there's two different kinds of reds and two different kinds of blacks. So in this experiment, they put in weird cards. So they put in like a black heart or a red spade. And then they show these cards to the guinea pigs in the experiment very, very quickly. And they asked people to name the cards. And at a fast rate, people named the strange card, as if they were cards in one of the suits. So if they saw a red spade, they'd either call it a spade or a heart. They put it into one of their predetermined categories. Everybody follow that? So you think there's four suits, and you're shown these strange cards, you think, okay, it's that suit. Then they gradually slow down the time that they were showing the cards. And at a certain point, most people, 75% of the guinea pigs, at a certain point would get, say, what is that? And at a certain point of speed, they'd say, that's a funny card. But 25% of the people never recognized the funny cards, no matter how slowly they were shown. They always put them into one of their preconceived categories. So this is another problem with trying to get an accurate map with our senses and knowledge. We already have something in our head, and we're not even aware that we have it in our head. Those people weren't even aware. It just hadn't occurred to them, what we call thinking out of the box. They weren't even aware that they were in a box. And if you read Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he talks about this. He coined the term paradigm. We have a paradigm through which we see the world. And we don't even know we have this paradigm. And the last problem with positivism is what's called underdetermination of theory by evidence. In other words, you have some evidence, but what's the story about the evidence? And there could be unlimited stories about the evidence. This is the problem with crime scenes. You go to the crime scene, there's a dead body, there's a bloody knife, but what story does this all tell? Well, it could tell lots of stories. You ever read a detective novel? You think it's telling one story, and the whole time you think, you know, Bill Moss did it. And then at the end of the story, you find out that the same evidence could tell a completely different story. And really, there's an unlimited number of stories that can be told about the same evidence. And evidence itself does not suggest a particular interpretation. You can say, you know, 10% of people like whole wheat bread better than white bread. Why? What's the story behind it? You don't know. There could be unlimited different reasons. All right, so there's all these different problems with forming a map based on the idea that I can understand reality with my senses and mind, and I'm going to come up with an objective reality that says, if you do this and this and this and this and this, you will achieve connection with life and creativity and autonomy and freedom and knowledge and authenticity. So I can't make an accurate map that way. There's all these problems with my map-making device. So the post-positivists say, okay, everybody makes their own map. There's no objective reality. Just sit down and make up your own map. Well, what's the problem with that? Should be obvious. Okay, everybody, there's no accurate maps from here to LA. Just sit down and make one up. How likely is it that you're going to get there? Maybe somebody will hit the jackpot. Right? And, of course, a logical problem with the post-positivists is they say, absolutely, there's no absolutes. Okay? Got that one. All right. So, we here in the Hare Krishna movement are going to give you an alternate proposal. So, of course, you could say, well, like everybody else is claiming to have a map, you also claim to have a map, and we do. We say here at the Hare Krishna movement that we can give you an accurate map. So why should you believe us? So I was thinking the other day, many times in our Back to Godhead magazine, of which I'm an editor, we get articles, how I came to the Hare Krishna movement. Why did I decide to become a devotee of Krishna? And I thought, maybe we should write something as to why I stay. Not just why I came, but why have I stayed? Because, I mean, you could try out a bunch of different maps in your life. Why you decide to try one? Why do you keep working with it? Why do you keep following this map to your destination? So I thought we'd look at a few different things. First of all, remember we talked about why you decide to follow a certain map to get to goals? One is you hear from people. So who is it that we're hearing from in the Hare Krishna movement as to why our map works? The Sanskrit term is shabda. or sound. So we're claiming, at least, that our map has come from the person who made the whole cosmos. You know, if you design the city, your map is going to be accurate, right? That makes sense? If you design the machine, and you also write the instruction manual, the manual is going to be accurate. So if there's someone who's designed the universe, then their map of the universe is going to be accurate. You could say, well, I mean, look, there's a lot of religions and spiritual associations out there. They all claim that they've gotten a map from the map maker and the creator of the universe, and all their maps are a little different. And I'd say, well, okay, you know, even if you're going to go from here to L.A., I'm sure there's more than one route to get to L.A., and I'm sure that they'll all work. Some of them, all the genuine routes work. Some may be a little slower. Some may be a scenic route. Some you may, you know, get stuck in traffic. So it's possible that to have more than one genuine route. But you'll find that there's something in common with all the genuine routes, and that is that they're all saying that the ultimate way to achieve all of our goals is in a union of love with God. So that you'll find in every genuine spiritual and religious tradition. And we call our process bhakti yoga. Yoga means union, and bhakti means love and devotion. That if you have a union of love and devotion with God, with the Supreme, then you will achieve all of your goals. And the path, the way to achieve that, is to start acting in love and devotion. So that you'll find in harmony. Some of the details may be a little different. Some of the external formalities. And I'll tell you in a minute why I think, obviously, I think that our particular map is the best, or I would be here, right? That makes sense? Okay, so I'm not going to apologize for that. Now, the next thing, if we look at logic and reason, if you examine the path and the goal given in these sacred writings, like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll find them very logically consistent. There's no gaps in them. There's no, well, this road might be under construction, we're not sure what's there, it's just sort of a little empty space. What I found with most of the religious and spiritual traditions in the world, although in essence they're teaching the same thing, they often have big gaps in their understanding. Well, what exactly happens when you die? Does your body stay in the ground, and after 1,000 years it kind of pops out again? Or do you just go to sort of an in-between? What do you do? And you'll find that those answers are often not in their scriptures. They're just not there. What's the nature of the world? Why do people suffer? Oh, those things aren't there. It's just missing information. And the adherents end up filling in the missing information by guessing. And so you'll have this particular group makes this guess, and this particular group makes this guess, and this group makes this guess. And they try to kind of support their guesses more or less indirectly through their scriptures. But what I found with these scriptures is there's no need to do that. There's just no gaps like that. Everything is answered, and it's all coherent. It all makes sense. And not only does it make sense from a purely logical point of view, but I could say from an emotionally logical point of view, if you can understand what I'm talking about. For example, if you want to say, well, the first created man and woman, they did a bad thing, and they rebelled against God, and therefore you got hit by a car. Now, that not only doesn't make any sense to me logically, but it's not emotionally logical to me. Like, why should I want to serve some creator who arranged the world that way? No, I don't like that arrangement. It doesn't sound fair to me. It doesn't move me. So you'll find in the Vedic scriptures that the logic is consistent. The more that you study them and the more you read them, like, oh, that explains this, and that explains this, and this goes together with this, and this goes together with that. And as far as experience, what's really nice about this process is we're not saying, okay, use our map, go on the route, and, you know, you're not going to know where you're going until you finally, when you die, hopefully you'll reach the destination. But there's going to be landmarks on the way. You know, if I go from here to L.A., it's not that I'm driving blindly and somehow, oh, here I am in L.A. No, there's going to be some marks on the road. It's going to start saying L.A., you know, 20 miles, right? L.A. this way with an arrow. So any practice of this process will start giving you at least a glimpse of these goals. It's not that you just have to reach the end point. Not only will it do that, but if you just adopt a little bit of this process, your life will markedly improve. Even if you don't adopt the whole process in this life, even if you say, okay, I'm just going to be a vegetarian and offer my food, or I'm just going to chant a little bit, or I'm just going to read a little book, or I'm just going to come to the temple and volunteer sometimes, you'll say, wow, I'm having so much more fun in my life. I'm so much more connected with other living beings. I feel so much more authenticity in my life. There's so much more creativity. I feel so much more myself. I have so much more of a sense of freedom, even from a little bit of practice. All right. Well, if you decide that you'd like to check out our map and see if it reaches to the destination, I have a few suggestions that you could make. I suggest that, I think probably many people here have already started on the process. I'd say if you've already started on the process, see if you can add something. Add something in terms of quality or add something in terms of quantity or both. And if you haven't started, my suggestion is try a little something. We don't charge for our mantras, right? We do charge for our books, but you can read them for free online. And do a little experiment. Try doing a little bit of reading on a regular basis or a little bit of chanting, like we're singing this mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. We also chant on beads as a private meditation. See if you can incorporate just a little and test for yourself. And finally, I'd say look at those people who have actually become successful. We talked about that in the beginning, right? You hear from some authority. You try yourself, you look at those who've achieved success. So we have many, many stories in our books of people in the past who've achieved success, who've attained all these ultimate goals in this life. And we also have many senior members of our Hare Krishna movement who are certainly far along on the path toward the goal that you can meet and talk to and say, would I like to be like them? Which means that those of us here who are seniors should actually be achieving the goal, not just kind of be hanging around the movement for a long time like a tree. So how about giving you something to think about and something you might want to add to your life? And we started a little late, but we have a few minutes if anybody would like to ask any questions. Yes, sir.
You know, it's very, very logical. It's enlightening in many ways. But my question is this. Why do you feel compelled to explain the other people's logical traps and try to explain away, saying this is a better logical trap? Why do you feel compelled to say that? The other thing I'm trying to tell you is this. Why didn't you say, you know what, realize God through dhyana or Krishna Prasadam?
I'm sorry?
Krishna Prasadam. You take Prasadam and you realize God. Dance and realize God.
There you go. Thank you.
Instead of saying that.
You said it for me.
Yeah, but why do you go back to logic again? Why do you feel compelled to explain away other people's logical traps?
Why do I feel compelled? If people just want to dance and chant, they can come at 7 o'clock. If they just want to dance and take prasadam. But I think people who come at 6 o'clock probably want to hear something else.
No, but you think it is worth spending 1 hour trying to...
If you didn't, you could leave. I wouldn't be offended. You could leave and chant in the courtyard. It's okay. Seriously, it's okay. Prabhupada says we have so many books, and if you're not interested in philosophy, then you can just chant and take prasadam. That's not a problem.
No, but my question.
I have one good friend who's been a member of the Hare Krishna movement for many, many years. And one day it was at some celebration, and people were getting up and speaking their hearts. And different people said different logical and philosophical things. And he got up and said, you know, it's just so much fun to be in the Hare Krishna room, and I love it. And he sat down. That's fine. That's no problem. Anybody else? I'm sure there are people who just show up at 7. Or maybe even just show up at 7:30. I'm sure there are people like that. That's fine. That's no problem. Yes?
My answer would be that actually, you know, absolute truth is beyond logic, cannot be achieved by logic. But we can use logic to convince people to start practicing. So if it works that way, eventually their benefit or realization would be on the basis of practice only. But at least we can, if somebody just gets convinced that way, you know, that's what our effort is.
Anyway, if it's the absolute truth, use the word absolute truth. If it's the absolute truth, then it should be logical, right?
Well, it's beyond mundane logic.
It's beyond mundane logic. But it should also beyond, but it should satisfy mundane logic, shouldn't it?
He would include, but
if it's truth, if you're using the word truth,
yes.
If it's truth, it should also satisfy mundane logic. It should go beyond that.
Yeah, it's beyond it, but simply only by mundane logic we can understand it. He's beyond that. But he cannot be produced by our logic because he's not impressed by that. So
he's beyond that already.
Yeah, he's beyond that. He's not impressed by our logical skills. So only by logic.
But then we'll have to come to a class in the morning where we give more classes on a Moodle.
So logic is those who like logic, we can discuss with them and
maybe I should have polled you before you came into the class today. Do you like logic or not? We could have had two classes here. One for the logical people and one for the people who don't care about logic. We'll try that.
Some people will be convinced by logic.
That's always like that.
Some people will not be convinced.
That's right. And what's wonderful about our Hare Krishna movement is we have a variety of speakers. And so if you don't like some of them, you can go and listen from others. That's okay. That's fine. One of our tenets is that we're all individuals. And each of us have our own individual way of presentation and understanding. So there may be other speakers who speak in a different way that's more exciting to other people, you know.
I think one thing that's interesting is that you can follow a process and achieve the results without ever understanding why the process works. There's many people who don't know what it would take to learn something, so they go to a school and every day the teacher says, do this, do this, do this, and they never see the big picture. They never need to see the big picture, but they still learn what it is they need to learn. And for the majority of people who come to the Hare Krishna movement, that's exactly what they do, is they have a guru, they come to the temple every day, and every day they follow the process, and it's not necessary for them to understand, well, why is it that if I stop consuming alcohol that it improves my consciousness?
True.
And they don't
that's
need
true.
To know. All they have to do is listen to the instructions of their guru.
Yes,
that's true. But for many people also, they're not even going to be interested in listening to those instructions unless they have a good reason to.
Yeah, most people need logic.
So it depends. It depends. I mean, what I see is some of it depends on what your background is, what your cultural background is. So often if I'm dealing with people from an Indian cultural background, they've already accepted it as axiomatic truth. But that's not necessarily true from people who aren't from an Indian cultural background. And people from an Indian cultural background who've been living in the West for a long time and whose children have been brought up in the West may not feel that.
Most of them do, but a lot of people in India also do not believe that.
They also want to hear some logic.
Yes. So that is a different.
But I'm saying if you've been brought up in a certain way, then you may not feel that you want to go through that process.
But I do agree with this gentleman here. The process is the one which is to be followed to get to the goal. You need not. I mean, you may or may not understand the logic. But in the process they're understood and you achieve the goal, that's it.
Well, it's interesting. Research has been done as to why people make a decision about anything. To buy a watch, to go see a movie, to take a nap, anything. And the final stage in every decision is not logic. It's emotion.
Yeah, that is the DNA built. So
the final step is always emotion, where you say yes. But if you'll notice, advertising, good advertising, usually combines both a little bit of both. Good advertising generally appeals to your emotions, and it also appeals to something else. Yes?
One comment. If you go to the scriptures that we have, the books that we have, and Srila Prabhupada's presentation on the basis of those books, a good portion of that, I think, is dedicated to showing how the material enterprise, trying to achieve happiness and those other goals, by material means, is irrational. In other words, it doesn't make any sense. And if that, forgetting about what the real way to that in Christian context, but if that is accomplished, and I think you did that That is very important. So logic is an important part of Krishna consciousness. There's all kinds of presentations of logic. And much of it is used to show how material life is irrational, because you're working very hard for something that is you're going to fail to achieve, namely happiness, security in the material world. So logic is essential. The whole Vedanta is logic.
Right. Well, basically what it is that each of us are working for these goals. Everybody here, every living being, not only every human being, but every living being is working for these goals. And each of us has a map that we feel is going to get there. So part of taking up spirituality is looking at the map you have and saying, is this a good map? Do I have a map that's going to get me there? Is it likely to work? What are the chances that this map I'm holding in my hand is valid? And one of the points that I wanted to make is that the people who are creating these maps in modern society, they themselves are saying, our maps are not accurate. They're not saying it in their commercials, but they're saying it to each other. They're saying it to the people who produce it. So if the people who are producing the maps know they're not accurate, why are we using them? And then our choices are either to say, well, there's no accurate maps, I'll just make one up. Or to go on the search for finding one. Saying, can I actually find one? Why find one? So I at least believe that we have one here. And I think I've tried to show that on the basis of both hearing from authority, or all three things, not both, hearing from authority, logic, and experience. And experience, of course, is not logical. Experience is just experience. On the basis of those three things, that there's an awfully good chance that this map works. And I know for sure the other one's not accurate. Yes?
I just want to make a small comment here. From the Vedic, I come from a family where they believe in the Vedic scriptures and stuff like that. So the whole gist of achieving the unification with the God, or Paramatma, is given by three-step process. One is jnana, the next is bhakti, and the third one is vairagya. So these three have to come together. Vairagya actually follows jnana and bhakti. That's what I heard.
They're very integrated. Yes, basically if you have a good map, you naturally become detached from the false ones. You don't really have to do much about it.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a map that's working, you're following the map and you see you're reaching your destination, it's not too much trouble to just toss the old one that wasn't accurate.
Right. The jnana is the map.
The jnana allows you to see what's the accurate map. Yes. And I think the last thing I should say, and then we're going to do our experiential with this gentleman.
No, we're really running out of time.
Oh, we're really running out of time. So just the thing I'd like to close with here is that not only do our scriptures really explain what's an accurate map, but they also, in detail, describe what happens when you achieve perfection. What is the spiritual world? And they achieve a reality, they describe a reality that's so attractive that even if there's only a small chance of achieving it, that it's certainly worth putting some effort into. So now we're going to have some experience. Thank you very much for your patience. All right.